for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Good afternoon, everybody.
I'm here. This is Jamil Zainashev, my co-host John Palmer. And this is Brew Strong, a show where you learn about all of those fancy brewing topics, the technical ones to the maybe not so technical, but all the things that have a great impact on your brewing, your beer, and answering all those questions that you might come across on the internet or the local homebrew shop, you know, wondering about one thing or another. And with us today in the studio, we have actually one of the people that impresses me most all the time is Colin Kaminsky. He's the brewmaster and many other things at a great place called Downtown Joe's in Napa, California, or Napa's, as JP would say.
You know, I'm not sure if I can live up to that introduction. But.
No. I was thinking about this the other night. You know, when we found out that you could be one of our hosts, I thought to myself, you know, every time I have a conversation with Colin, it makes me think. Not it makes me think you're crazy, but it makes me.
Well, that as well, I'm sure.
It makes me think. You know, we'll be talking about something that I feel I know quite a bit about some subject, and we'll talk for a few minutes, and you'll say a few things that will make me, you know, think through what I know or don't know, and or you know it opens up you know my thought process to, well, maybe I need to, you know, reevaluate this in a different way, or you know, consider these other factors. And I find that just fascinating, you know. So if you notice, every time we have a conversation, there comes a point where I stop talking, my eyes glaze over, and my mouth hangs open. I've reached that point where I need to stop and think, and I can't.
But you always get back to me, and I really appreciate that about our conversations. So it's not like it's been a dead thought.
Right. Well, but what is amazing to me is you're able to converse in so many different topics and on such a high level of knowledge, and it's just amazing. So it's great to have you here in the studio, and you know, today we're talking about metals. So we got you know, Colin, who has done a lot with metals, especially you were doing a lot of equipment design and creation of all sorts of gadgets at Moore Beer for a while, and then John Palmer, he's a metallurgist by trade, right?
That's right.
Metal in engineering at 3M. So you know, if anybody knows the subject, it's these guys. And
yeah. Good to have you here,
least,
Colin.
Oh, it's good to be here. Thank you.
It's great,
John,
to have Tasty McDowell here. And it's just because, you know, he brings beer, and it's always really tasty.
I always bring the beers.
What beer did you
bring?
Well,
frankly, I thought the show was on metals, not metals. So I was going to come over and steal all yours because I knew you'd bring them.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Anywho, you know, earlier today, I was wandering around down, as Tasty was. We were checking out the hotel that's hosting the 2009 National Homebrew Conference.
Very sweet. Well, we can't tell them what it is.
It's in Oakland.
Okay.
It's the Marriott. You heard it here first.
It's the YMCA.
Oakland? Well, okay.
Marriott City Center.
There's a guy that can keep a secret.
Yeah, there's a guy who keeps a secret. Who? Is he here? No, it's certainly not me. But, yeah, the Oakland Marriott City Center. And I'll tell you, that is one fine hotel for a conference.
Oh, yeah.
It's the convention center. We're going to have more space than we ever had before,
yeah,
for the conference.
Yeah.
You know, you walk right out of the hotel door, and there's nice restaurants right across the street.
A BART station.
I mean, a BART station. You can see from you're standing at the hotel entrance, yeah, of the hotel. You can see the BART station. It's that close.
Yeah.
You know, they were saying it's two blocks. It's two halves of, or two quarters of a block, so it's maybe a half a block away.
Yeah.
And then you know, the great space, and there's a brew pub right there, right next to,
yeah,
the Pacific Coast. We went there today for lunch and had some beers. They had Pliny on.
Yeah.
They had an Avery Brown.
Yeah, they have a good selection.
Yeah, it's great. And very impressed with that facility. I'm really looking forward to it. That's going to be a great conference. If you'd never been, I tell you, this is the finest beer event you'll ever go to. I've been to all sorts of different beer events, and that's right. absolutely fantastic.
So, come early, too, if you can.
Yeah, if you're not an AHA member, you go to the Brewing all Network right. store. You can buy your membership right there. A portion of it goes to the Brewing Network, helps them out. A portion goes to AHA, helps them out, and gets you all sorts of discounts, including a discount to the conference that pays for itself. So June 2009, June 18th, I think it is when the conference starts.
Yeah.
And you'll want to be there. I think the Brewing Network is going to hold their anniversary party same time. So you'll be able
at
to do
the
both.
Convention?
Yeah. That same week, yeah.
We don't know where yet. We just know it'll be that week because listeners have always had a tough time deciding, am I going to spend my money going to the BN anniversary or am I going to go to NHC? And we've always said go to NHC, but now you get to do both.
Well, you know, yep. June 17th is my birthday, so maybe we just all have a big birthday party
go.
At Joe's
and it's a big
have
bash.
It be the listener party. And
it could do all of it at once.
Yeah.
That would be one hell of a bash.
Yeah, we had the last anniversary party at Downtown Joe's in Napa's. Colin was kind enough to have us there, and it was fantastic. I had pneumonia and was kind of walking around like a zombie, but I still had a good time. That's how good a time it was.
I do have a question. Did you get the stage fixed that we broke?
Yeah, you know, I had to weld up some new stuff.
You did?
We re-engineered the stage. You know, it was built out of folding beds.
Okay.
It wasn't really designed to have, eight fat chicks kissing on you.
I felt bad, but I kind of thought, you know what? That's rock and roll. We broke Colin's stage. I'm glad you got it fixed.
Yeah, 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 that's what happens when you invite the beer people over.
That
you
element,
know,
yeah, it's a bad
tends to. I think the average weight tends to be a little higher than when they say the elevator will hold like eight people. They mean like six beer dudes. You know, not quite eight. All right, so we're going to be talking about metals today, metals and how they affect your beer, and the internet type rumors that you hear, and all the various things about aluminum or lead or brass or all that sort of stuff.
Zinc, plutonium
in your beer. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So when we come back from break, we will get into a listener email that kind of sparked this whole conversation off.
Awesome.
We'll be back right after this.
Right. Brew smart.
Brew strong.
This is Brew Strong. What's good for the earth, good for your body, and great for your brew? Organic ingredients. This October, the Organic Ingredient Experts, Seven Bridges Co-op in awesome Santa Cruz, California, hosts the second annual Organic Homebrew Challenge. All ingredients must be organic. Entries will be accepted September 1st through October 10th. Judging October 19th will be followed by an organic Oktoberfest for all participants, customers, and guests at Gordon Biersch Brewery and Restaurant in downtown San Jose, including a specially brewed Gordon Biersch Organic beer. For more information, contest rules, and guidelines, visit breworganic.com/competition. And if you're looking for organic ingredients, Seven Bridges offers a huge selection of USDA certified kits and raw ingredients, from 8 ounces to 50 pound sacks of grain, whole and pellet hops, and all the equipment you'll need. Seven Bridges, the organic homebrew expert since 1997. Visit www.breworganic.com and enter the 2008 Organic Homebrew Challenge.
What have you gotten out of a vial of White Labs yeast?
WLP001, Cal Ale, baby!
23, Burton Ale.
008, East Coast Ale.
Cal Common, WLP810.
It's gonna be WLP400 with beer!
I got a sweet hoodie for my vial.
Huh?
White Labs, your source for great brewer's yeast, would like to invite all homebrewers to join the White Labs Customer Club. Redeem your empty vials for great White Labs merchandise and products. Free yeast, glassware, t-shirts, baseball caps, sweatshirts, polo shirts, and you won't believe what you'll get for 5,000 vials. Members also receive a newsletter packed with White Labs updates and facts, interviews with professional brewers, brew your own clone recipes, beercook.com recipes, and customer club stories. The White Labs Customer Club. Save your vials and get in the club. White Labs. It's all in the vial.
Did you know that every day a brewcaster goes to bed hungry? Did you know that that brewcaster is silently calling for the help of people just like you? Do you know that every day the unicorn and the rainbow have to blow sailors for loose change? For less than the cost of a half-calf, quad-shot, venti, extra-hot, soy milk, triple-pump, hazel, low-fat foam, double-cupped macchiato a day, you can help starving adults in Pacheco. Your love can be felt for as little as 7 cents a day. Visit thebrewingnetwork.com/donate to sign up today for as little as $2 a month. Private first class in the BN Army. Buy your way up the ranks as corporal, sergeant, ranger, or colonel with an easy-to-do monthly donation that keeps brewcasters alive and your favorite internet radio station broadcasting. No donation is too small to help those in need. Can't you find it in your heart to share your love with a brewcaster? In return, you will enjoy the wealth of knowledge that comes with every episode of The Session, The Jameel Show, and yes, even that other show. Thank you for listening, and please sign up for your donation at thebrewingnetwork.com/donate today.
This is www.thebrewingnetwork.com.
Sit down next to it, grab yourself a paper towel, and watch those yeast have sex.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back, and we are talking about metals and how metals will are part of the brewing process. You know, you got your kettles, you got your chillers, you got fermenters, things like that. And the question a lot of people have is how that affects your beer, or things like how you treat the metals. So like, do you process? How do you treat brass, or your stainless? How do you make sure your stainless is in good shape? And what kicked this whole thing off is John and I got a question through the BrewStrong@thebrewingnetwork.com email address. If you have questions for us at Brew Strong. Again, it's brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com, and we'll get all those. We won't respond to them, but we will take those in as show ideas and things like that. And
we'll often respond to them on the air, of course.
Yeah, we'll respond to them on the air. Very good point.
Yeah, we'll just ignore them completely.
John's been drinking less than I have. Yeah, we'll just ignore them. I'll use it to wipe after I printed it out. And so, Jeff had asked us, Jamel and John, I'm currently using a 15-gallon Megapot bought from Northern Brewer. Great, great company, great store, northernbrewer.com. I bought it pre-drilled for the spigot and thermometer. I love the pot, but there is one issue I have with this, and it is with the lid. I would like the lid to sit nicely when I have my immersion chiller in it. To do this, I need to cut about a 1.5 by 3 inch long notch into the stainless steel lid. I have read so many different people's opinions on this subject, and answers just make me a bit confused. Some people tell me it needs to be plasma cut. Some people say only professionals should do it, while other people tell me I can do it with a Dremel. I've also read I should cut with a saw at slow RPM. Since John is great with metals, I hope you guys can answer this question on the show. And I think this points out a very interesting thing, is that when it comes to equipment in brewing on the internet and amateur brewers, there's all sorts of questions and there's all sorts of crappy answers out there. I mean, there's all sorts of, like this, plasma to using a slow RPM saw. And, what I told them and what my solution was. So I'm like, I'm sure John will have the correct answer. My answer was I took out my aviation snips and I just rattled off a big old hole. Looks like hell, but it works. And, that's what I did. So, John, you know, tell us the answer specifically to this one, and then why don't you kind of go in to metals a little bit in general for us?
Okay. Well, stainless is tough stuff to cut. It's you know, aluminum is dead easy, but stainless tends to dull your tools and to gall a little bit. Lots of different ways to do it. I think plasma, you know, plasma torch or an acetylene torch or something like that, way overkill. For just cutting a slot in the lid to accommodate the immersion chiller, I think a hacksaw is probably adequate. I mean, if you're, you know, rather than going out and buying, you know, a new saw or something to cut it with, I think it's just a simple hacksaw would get the job done, and then you can use a file to smooth the edges. But if you do if you use a saber saw or a Sawzall with a metal blade, and you're concerned about corrosion after cutting stainless, then you're going to want to clean up the edges. You can use, you know, and it's good to use a non-metallic, say like sandpaper on the edges, because anytime you cut stainless with regular steel, like carbon steel, or even, you know, high carbide drill bits and such, you open up the door for corrosive attack because you break through the passive layer.
That, and it kind of contaminates it. Is that the case?
Yeah. You get non-stainless metal put onto the stainless.
Yeah,
and it's like an infection, contamination.
You were saying that previously, Colin. When I think when I picked up some equipment at Moorbeer, you would tell me, you know, if you're going to do any cutting, you know, don't you got to make sure, you know, stainless on stainless or.
Well, yeah, one of the things we used to run into at Moorbeer was when people be grinding metal near something stainless. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're grinding plain steel, and you'd end up with all of those that shower of sparks mm-hmm. going onto something that was stainless, mm-hmm. and yeah. it would just cause pits everywhere, and it was really hard to passivate once that happened. You know, we'd scrub it down really hard with a scrubby and soapy water, and then we'd run it through a passivation cycle,
like a green scrubby, a 3M green scrubby, or then they have the white scrubbies.
They're just finer, aren't they?
I don't know. It's like they say made for stainless from 3M, and it's like, well, if 3M says it's made for stainless, that's good enough for me.
I think it's just how coarse the polish is.
It doesn't do any scratching whatsoever.
Right, is why we like the green ones, because they roughed everything up really good.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you could match the brush pattern.
Well, what about stainless types? You know, so that's one question I always have is, right, you know, there's all these, you know, 308, you know, mm-hmm. 318.
What is it? 3, you know, 312 and 306.
454, you know, 999, whatever it takes.
Are the food grade ones, John?
The 304. You'll also, 304 is the main stainless steel. And you, as far as like a beer keg, those are made out of 304L, because the L means low carbon, which facilitates welding. If you try to weld regular 304 and you do a sloppy job, you're going to get cracking. If you do it really slow, the lower carbon helps you, gives you more time to complete the weld before you start getting cracking. And the cracking is long term. That's it. There's a phenomenon called sensitization, where the heat allows the chromium to diffuse to the grain boundaries and form chromium carbides. That's why low carbon helps, because you have less carbides to form, and the formation of the carbides makes the surrounding steel unstainless, because it ties it up. So if you weld stainless steel like 304 and you do it slowly with lots of heat, then it gives time for that sensitization to happen. And down the road, you know, after it's been in service for, you know, a month, you'll start noticing corrosion and cracking there at the weld, in the weld area. So, the main steel is 304. You'll also see 316.
That's the other one. That's the cheaper one that we used to go to when we were trying to save money.
Well, that these days, that one can be more expensive because it has more nickel and molybdenum in it, too. You'll often see 316 used for fittings and piping.
Is it more machinable?
It's more corrosion resistant.
Oh, okay.
It's more resistive to pitting than 304L.
And so, tell me if I'm wrong. The way I look at stainless steel is it's like a dirty snowball. You know, there's a crystalline structure that's isolated in a matrix. I'm trying to really oversimplify this. And when we heat it up, what we do is we start making the dirt go away from the snowball, and it becomes less corrosion resistant. Is that a kind of a fair way to oversimplify things?
I'm not sure. I haven't figured out what that means yet.
Well, you're talking about, you know, there's a crystalline structure. To me, that's the dirt and the snowball.
Or another way, take a handful of jelly beans and press them together into a ball. Yeah, so they all stick together. Each jelly bean is what we call a grain, and that contact between two jelly beans that are stuck together is the grain boundary. And and as you say, you know, the dirt, or say, what else could we throw in? Maybe like the candy shell. If you give it some heat, that's going to coalesce, and you're going to get a concentration gradient. What really happens is the chromium that's diffused out, you know, all throughout the grain, and that's what provides the stainless capability, is the chromium. And
it's chromium oxide, right?
Yeah, forms chromium oxide at the surface, and so you have that element diffused, you know, homogeneously throughout the grain.
And when you're talking about heat, you're talking about like welding heat, or, you know, you're not talking about
or a propane burner heat too.
Really, anything that changes the color of it. So somewhere around 600 degrees, is that where it starts to change?
So if you were heating up your
600 up to 800,
heating up your kettle without any liquid in it, that, you know, you could reach these temperatures. But if you got wort in there, you'd be okay.
That's right.
Yeah, but if you're turning stainless blue, you're changing the metallurgy.
That's right. Yeah, and that's I'll talk about heat tint in a second, but so let's just go back to the jelly bean model. you got this compacted wad of jelly beans, and each jelly bean is a particular grain, the joints between jelly beans are the grain boundaries. You get diffusion to the grain boundaries of the chromium. It makes the adjacent area non-stainless, and that's how it corrodes. Or if you stick a gumdrop onto that wad of jelly beans. That's different. That's electrochemically different than the jelly beans, and that allows corrosion to initiate at that site.
So when we were grinding steel next to stainless, for instance.
That's right.
You're putting gum on your wad, and that's what's causing the problem.
That's right.
Okay, so I like the jelly bean model. I think that that's better than my snowball analogy.
Other types of stainless, I guess, was the question, right?
Well, yeah, but where I wanted to go with the jelly bean model, though, just to get my head straight here before we start here, is that shell on that jelly bean, that's got to have chromium in it. Because if somehow we migrate the chromium away from the surface, we're not stainless anymore.
That's right.
And also, if we don't oxidize that chromium, we're not stainless anymore. So passivation is really just oxidizing that chromium.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing, too, on passivation. Clean stainless steel will oxidize instantaneously on exposure to air. So chemical passivation is not necessary to have passive stainless steel. If you clean it well with a cleanser and soap and a scrubby, you know, you've got a clean stainless steel surface, that's passive. Now, you can enhance the passivity by doing a nitric acid wash, a hot nitric acid wash, which will preferentially dissolve iron at the surface away, leaving behind a chromium-rich surface. And that enhances the corrosion resistance of the stainless steel.
And that's why nitric works better on welds then, because we've somehow migrated the surface of our jelly bean away, And when we use nitric on a weld, we're actually taking some of the iron away and exposing fresh chromium.
Yes, to a large extent, yes. There's also, and it's like I say, it's not totally necessary. You can also use a scrubby and cleanser to clean up a weld. And the heat tint I was talking about was, if you do welding or if you do cutting or grinding where, you know, that starts to turn blue, like you mentioned, that heat tint is a non-passive oxide. And that and if you submerge that in the beer or wort or water or whatever, that's going to corrode. That's a nice initiation site, because all around it you've got clean stainless steel, it's nice and passive, and then you've got this blue spot that's not as passive, and that's where it's going to corrode. So what you need to do is take a scrubby and some cleanser, like kitchen cleanser, or you know, something similar, and scour that heat tint off. And then that will, like I say, once you've got that clean, got that heat tint away, that will repassivate in the air, and you're passive again.
Fascinating. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Well, you know, we used to say that a half hour of air passivated.
Well, and scrubbing the blue off, and the need to do that.
You don't want the blue.
You know, most people haven't heard that.
Yeah. So you know, 10 years ago, I used to say, you'd need to give it some time to passivate. And then I was talking with one of my friends at NASA that had read that I'd said that somewhere on the internet, and called me up and corrected me. And sure enough, I mean, all the books these days say, yeah, instantaneous passivation if it's clean.
So you just need to clean it really well. So if it's blue, you rub it really hard until the blue goes away, and then. And then,
just like blue balls, is that?
It helps.
And then, once it's clean, it'll become passive on its own. It'll tend to passivate.
You know, yeah, navel jelly is good for that.
Navel jelly, okay.
I have navel lint, but I don't have any.
I generally use like KY jelly. Is that the same thing?
No, that's some sort of organic.
Okay. Wouldn't be the same. So if I think, you know, probably for brewers, you know, your average amateur brewer, the thing we're most concerned about on stainless is, all right, the kettle that I use and maybe, you know, kegs and maybe other parts like fittings. You know, what kind of stainless am I looking for? Is that 316? Is that 304?
All of your pots are going to be 304. Or
202.
Yeah, 202 is a low nickel version that works just as well for food, and it's just cheaper because of the lower nickel content.
Okay.
Yeah, and, you know, for those listeners out there, metals are really expensive now, and so saving money while you're alloying things really saves a lot. Metal is really expensive right now.
Is there any kind of, you know, thing we should watch out for? The consumer going out and you know, he asks about a pot and they say, well, it's you know, 3.5. Yeah. What's that?
If you get a 301 stainless, that's not terribly stainless. Very often these days you can find 416 stainless and 410. 416, 420. No, 416. What we call a ferritic stainless. You know, the cheap stainless steel silverware that you get in the cafeteria at school?
Mm-hmm.
That magnet will stick to?
Yeah. And magnets will stick to brew pots, too. So that's not a perfect screener. But let me go back to the silverware. The flatware. Stainless steel flatware is a ferritic stainless. It's not as corrosion resistant as 304. So if you're at like Walmart and you find a thin, you know, cheap stainless steel pot, it's probably a ferritic stainless, and you won't be able to weld on it without corrosion issues like you can with 304L and 316L. So the really cheap stainless steel pots, stay away from.
Well, other than welding, is it okay if you use a weldless fitting?
Yeah, I guess it it should probably be okay. I mean, I'm just trying to draw a difference is you have good stainless and you got cheap stainless. The cheap stainless, more can go wrong with it in terms of corrosion.
Now, but cheap stainless is still better than the best aluminum, right?
Well, that was my question. No, would you go aluminum instead?
Well, okay. It's a matter of your priorities when it comes to brew pots. Do you want materials that avoid hot spots and avoid scorching? Then aluminum is your best bet. Do you want something that you can just pour caustic on and clean up? Well, in that case, then the stainless is better because caustic and aluminum don't go well together. You need to use more elbow grease and less chemicals when you're working with aluminum.
What about transferring aluminum into the wort? Is that an issue?
No, it isn't.
So at the pH of 4-ish, we don't pick up enough aluminum that it's a problem?
That's right. Now, the caveat to that is if it's a bright and shiny aluminum.
So it doesn't have aluminum oxide on the surface.
Right. You want aluminum brew pots to season, just like in cooking. You know, you get a brand new one off the shelf at the store, bring it home, boil some water in it, fry something in it, you know, season that thing up so it turns dull. Then it's inert. Then you're not going to have any problems with any metallic flavors when you brew. But if you were to use it, you know, straight off the shelf, like a brushed aluminum finish inside, put your wort in it and start boiling without, you know, boiling water in it first or anything, that's when you're going to get a metallic off flavor. And it's only going to be an off flavor. You're not going to have to worry about poisoning yourself or Alzheimer's or anything like that. It's going to just be an off flavor that you pick up. But with time and with proper treatment, that goes away completely.
Well, and one of the things to worry about with aluminum, like you're saying, is anything highly either acidic or caustic is a problem with aluminum, right? It ends destroying your pot. If you're the lazy sort, you really don't want to do this with any equipment. But
you fill it up and leave it.
Yeah, if you're lazy and getting it cleaned, you know the aluminum pot's gonna be destroyed really quick. The stainless is going to last a little longer before that boundary between like the water and the air starts to pit on the stainless. That'll happen too, but the aluminum's going to go down on you really fast. I didn't mean that. But and on
the
aluminum,
what's her phone number again?
She's called aluminum. The aluminum, there's the Alzheimer's things. There's no relationship there. There's maybe a relationship, but it has nothing to do with ingesting something that's been cooked in aluminum. So I think that's
I've put an aluminum foil over lasagna and had it turn into a black corroded mess.
Right, because of the acidity.
Because
of
the acidity of the tomatoes. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I tell my wife, I said, don't cover the lasagna with aluminum foil. She's like, why? Plastic every time. Yeah.
Well, and I'm just as afraid of PVC anymore.
And the BPAs and all that good stuff. Yeah, it'll all kill you. Speaking of stuff that'll kill you, what about lead?
What about brass? Let's talk about brass and machinability and all of that.
Yeah, brass is a very useful brewing metal because you can get good long-lasting fittings to use in your setup
for cheap.
They're cheap cheaper, and like copper, if you treat it right, it becomes inert to the wort, and you won't have any corrosion issues. Now. There's two kinds of brass that you'll see here in the United States at Home Depot or the hardware stores. There's a yellow brass, which contains about 3% lead for machinability, and there's a red brass, which contains zero lead. The red brass is dark. It's very coppery colored,
and it's cast, right?
It's cast, yeah.
So you can see the casting sand marks in it.
Yeah, it's rougher.
Yeah.
That contains zero lead. And but the yellow brass contains 3%. And that you can remove that surface lead. But, 3% by weight is a very small amount, and especially when you start considering that you're only, that's 3% of the entire weight, not just the surface area. So, a very small amount. It doesn't dissolve off readily. It takes a lot of lead to poison you.
Well, and then, and in the ideal world, we're taking this fitting, we're using it like it was supposed to, and we're putting it into, say, a tap water system, and our alkalinity goes and coats it over anyways. So, in your drinking water, it's not a problem at all because it's always being recoated with alkalinity.
Or at least it's not corroding in that environment, yes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, see, and there's one thing. I was concerned about that because I use brass fittings, use them forever. And I prefer them over the plastic fittings, personally, just because the larger diameter, all that stuff. And the fact that the heat up doesn't bother me, I'm just used to them, and I use those. And people ask me all the time, they say, Jamil, I see on the pictures of your system, you use some brass fittings. Aren't you concerned about the lead? And so I did a little research, and I don't know the answer to this, and don't, be doing anything based off of my opinion because, I'm a nut job anyways. But, for me, if you're feeding your beer to a child, then I would be concerned because
you're feeding beer to a child.
Right. But the amount of lead that might be coming off in off those fittings, perhaps there could be an issue because children, they'll absorb it and their brain's
developing.
Right. Well, but and, for and me, my brain's not developing that, anymore.
Yeah, we're shedding cells at this point in life.
And if you have a proper diet as well, that helps your body flush the lead out as well. So
right,
it's
milk
pretty,
will help, yeah.
Pretty hard for you to build up a toxic level of lead as an adult drinking, beer that's been brewed with a couple of brass fittings. That's my take on it. I could, if you die of lead poison, it's your own damn fault.
So, I used to find actually that the lead fittings on the wort side of the brewery would corrode, and the brass fittings rather on the wort side would corrode, but the ones on the hot liquor side wouldn't. So when I got to Downtown Joe's, I started replacing all the brass on the acidic side. And eventually had enough budget that I replaced them all, and I'm running all stainless now. But
matched up to stainless?
Yeah, they were. It was brass threaded into stainless.
Yeah, and the reason those are corroding because it's a galvanic reaction. It's like a battery. You've got an electrolyte, the beer or the wort, and you've got two dissimilar metals there. You're creating a battery, and that encourages corrosion.
That makes perfect sense to me.
So, but going back to lead for a second, in terms of chronic toxicity, toxicity that builds up from lead, normal environmental intake of lead is about 0.3 milligrams a day for everybody, in modern society. 92% of what you ingest is excreted in the feces. So, even if you're drinking, your entire 5 gallons of wort, not letting the yeast take any of it out of solution or anything, and letting it settle down in the trub. If you're drinking just the straight wort, and most of that would be excreted and decrease over time. So it takes a lot of lead to poison you.
Well, and the yeast really has an affinity towards metals in any case. So
that's right.
It's going to try to pull
copper, iron, zinc, all the metals, all the cations that are going to be in the wort are going to be absorbed to a large extent by the yeast and carried out of solution.
So I think what we need to do is get somebody like one of the Schumanns and do an experiment and see how much lead it really does take to kill you.
They'd be fine with that.
As long as it's
I think we need to make it more scientific than that. What we need to do is take one of them,
get a normal human,
and give them IQ tests on a weekly basis, right? And then keep feeding them more and more lead.
They'll probably get smarter. It'll test higher as you give them more lead.
And they go from window lickers to dead. I'm not sure what happens there.
Let's see what kind of result you're going to get from that. Anybody you're willing to test less lead toxicity on, not somebody very bright in the first place. Okay, we're going to take a short break, And when we come back, we've got, you know, just this topic is just full of great questions. So when we come back, we'll dive into more of these questions and get them answered. Back right after this.
Keep your carboy cap on. This is Brew Strong. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sean O'Sullivan, the brewmaster and co-founder of the 21st Amendment Brewery and Restaurant in San Francisco. 6 years ago, Nico Freccia and I opened the 21st Amendment on 2nd Street with the intent of bringing back the local neighborhood brew pub. Well, the neighborhood has really changed over the years, but the 21st Amendment still remains a great place for people to meet over a terrific meal and a tasty pint of beer. In the past, the only way you could enjoy the 21st Amendment's handcrafted beers was at the brew pub. Well, all that has changed. Now, the 21st Amendment beers are available in cans. That's right, cans. When was the last time you had a great beer in a can? Well, that day has come. We're offering our world-famous Watermelon Wheat and 21A IPA in cans. Cans are a better package than glass because cans keep the beer fresher longer, but you can also take cans to places where bottles can't go, like the beach, lake, golf courses, and sporting events. So join us in the revolution to take back the can from the big breweries and crack open a cold 21A craft beer in a can. The 21st Amendment, 563 2nd Street in San Francisco, just two blocks from Giants Park.
Oh, crap. It's the hop shortage. He's in the basement.
Oh, please. My triple decocted Imperial Pilsner.
It's all gone. We'll never brew again.
Damn this hop shortage. Damn it to hell.
Was ist los? Hop shortage?
Who are you guys?
Ich bin Doppelbock.
Ich bin Kölsch.
Und ich bin Münchener Helles.
We don't need a lot of hops to be delectable.
Now brew something malty.
Use less hops, brew more beer. Northern Brewer has kits and ingredients for dozens of worldwide beer styles that don't require a lot of hops to make a great pint, like the Cool Blonde Kolsch or the ponderously bottom-heavy Doppelbock. Keep drinking great beer. Order at northernbrewer.com and get flat rate $7.99 shipping anywhere in the contiguous U.S. One beer kit, $7.99 shipping. 1 million beer kits, $7.99 shipping.
Together we can beat this hop shortage.
Now get brewing!
Live. Beer Radio. The Brewing Network.
The Brewcasters.
If you're just starting, don't be discouraged by all this stuff. Exactly. It's so easy.
Just throw it together.
Put some sugar and some water and some yeast in there.
Yeah.
Brewing Network.
Like the Lance Armstrong of the beer world. Except for that nut thing. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking metals in brewing. And, I told John, he was like, it's not an exciting topic for me. I'm like, yeah, because you know everything about this, but... You know, people out there, they're dying for this information to talk to an expert and be able to get exactly the right answer instead of, nonsense that they might pick up elsewhere. And so,
I thought everybody knew this stuff.
No, you do. Yeah, sorry.
John, you're actually changing some of my views on some of this, so... So this is good for me, and I've been dealing with metals and brewing for 10 years.
And again, one of the things I love about Colin is, like, I can say something, and, even something stupid, and he'll go, well, all right, I'll consider it, and see if it's worthwhile. The answer is usually no, but he's very open to learning, things from other people, and I tell you, if you ever get a chance to talk to Colin, go down to Downtown Joe's in Napa's, and... if he's there and he's not too busy, talk to him about whatever subject, from, making your own guitars to, pimping out your ride to who knows what, gliders, holography, all sorts of stuff. Just fascinating individual. And he'll just blow your mind just in a conversation where he's not trying to impress you. He may ask you a question. And that question will just, like, all of a sudden screw up your world, and you'll have to really think. if you haven't been thinking before, after talking to Colin, you'll really be thinking, which is again, one of the reasons I really love talking to this guy and having him here in the studio is great. All right, so we're talking metals, and there's a lot of questions on stainless. Anyway, the live chat, I'll tell you, it's very active. A lot of good questions coming in the live chat. If you're listening live, you go to the main website, hit the chat now button, and it'll take you in there. You don't need to enter in a password or anything. Just enter in your name, and you can join in with like-minded individuals and talk about the subjects we're talking about and ask questions that we'll answer at the end of the show in our final running segment. And you'll find out some very interesting stuff in there. All right, so here's a couple of things that came up in various emails and chats with other people at conferences. For example, a friend of mine, he came over with his wife, and we were all brewing together, and they had some sort of a disagreement about the copper immersion chiller, and his was getting kind of a black coating on it. And she
copper
was,
oxide.
and it was falling off into the beer when he brewed, and she was worried about it. And he'd leave it out for a while, and then next time he brewed, he put it in and come out shiny. And she's like, "Well, where'd all that black stuff go? It's in the beer." Or sometimes, it'll start to turn green. The copper will, and do you want to put that in your wort? I mean, what's up with that? What is it? And what's the danger there?
You get a couple of oxides with copper. You get a black oxide, and you get a green oxide. And the green oxide is known as verdigris, which apparently means green in Italian. Those oxides are more soluble in acids, in wort, in other words, than copper itself.
That's why it comes out shiny.
Yeah, yeah. So what you want to do is if your immersion chiller is all black or starting to turn green, you want to clean that first. Clean it with kitchen cleanser or clean it with vinegar. Get that looking reasonably clean. I mean, more copper colored than black, if you know what I mean.
So what happens? What is the path of that copper oxide as it goes through our beer?
Well, it dissolves into the wort, and then it is a yeast nutrient, and so some of it will actually be metabolized by the yeast. A lot of it will just be absorbed by the yeast and bound up with the tannins and the other trub in the wort and carried out of solution. So even if you do put a dirty wort chiller in your wort, you're not going to get a lot of copper in your beer.
I mean, here's what happened to us in California. I have a copper brew kettle, and so I was part of this study. The state of California decided that they were going to go through all brew houses that had copper brew kettles, and what they were going to do was measure the residual copper in the finished product. So they took pictures of our setups, and it was like 20 or 30 breweries. They took pictures of our setups, and then they took samples out of our faucets, and they brought them all back to the lab, and they measured them for residual copper, and they found none. Now, my kettle doesn't ever turn black, so I can't say that, having a black kettle isn't a danger. But what they did do is they were trying to actually force us all to go to stainless kettles, and right. They could find no evidence to move us to stainless. And copper has such a big benefit during the boil, chemistry-wise, that right. I'm really happy that we were able to do that.
So
yeah, that's the magic of copper in brewing, is that it is very beneficial in the boil. It helps take a lot of sulfur out of the beer. And that was one thing that the Germans noticed 20, 30, 40 years ago, is when everybody started switching to stainless steel systems, is that they noticed a lot more sulfur in the beer, a lot more sulfur character.
And the beer's got lighter in color as well.
Yeah. Well, it made a big taste difference.
In the wine industry, I know they use copper to reduce sulfur as well, right? And then, so So copper is one question, Colin, on the experiment done by the state of California. Are you saying that there was no copper detected in the wort after the boil?
No,
or
in the finished beer.
In the finished beer.
That's all they cared about. So all they did was take a picture of the system, take samples of the finished beer, and then we didn't hear from them for a year. And suddenly we read in the newspaper, copper's okay for brewing.
So copper can assist in yeast health like zinc can.
It can, but there's lots of copper in barley. Mm-hmm. So zinc is the only metal that's a little deficient in barley that you might want to supplement if you're reusing your yeast a lot, like we do in breweries. If you're only using your yeast once, then you don't need to add zinc.
Depends where it's grown, too, the barley. There might be more copper or certain
areas. I would assume, but I don't know.
Right? Uh-huh.
Yeah. But copper does some other things. You know, it also goes through the sulfur reaction that you guys are talking about. But it also, when you make caramel in as a candy maker, you make it in a copper bowl. And the reason why you use a copper bowl is because it helps the reaction that turns sugar to caramel colors and flavors. And if I remember right, that's either the Browning reaction or the Maillard reaction. Neither of you know for sure? That's one of those
same
two
thing.
Reactions.
The Maillard reaction.
Maillard, is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah,
that's a problem with only reading books.
But copper, I know, like copper sulfate. Yeah, you use that. I used to lifeguard at a private lake up in the hills somewhere, and they used to throw in clothes optional. Run around there naked,
I didn't need now.
To throw in copper sulfate to beat down the algae in the lake. And
it is a poison, and that's one of the things, and it's
level,
blue
right?
too. So that's one of the things, you know, when
like
I was
Viagra.
When I'm looking at the edge of my hot liquor tank, which is also copper, you know, there's a blue ring around the outside edge where it overflows. Mm-hmm. I have a little spill lip. And one of the things that's always concerned me, and maybe John, you can help me answer a question I've had for years, is that blue ring then the blue version of copper oxide, or because I'm adding gypsum to that, is that copper sulfate?
It's copper sulfate. Oh, yeah.
Sulfate.
That's a poison, right? So yeah. I should scrub that blue ring off, right?
You should. Well, you should clean that off.
Yeah.
I mean,
don't lick it off.
It's outside. You know, it's outside.
It's outside of the brew process. I mean, right. Because it's on the spill lip, but I don't want a poison hanging around the brewery.
That's right. Yeah. Copper sulfate is toxic on a couple levels. One, because it is a sulfate, but partly because the sulfate is easily metabolizable in the body, and so you're able to get a lot of copper into your body by eating copper sulfate.
So calcium sulfate's not a problem because I want the calcium in my body.
Right.
But
right.
copper sulfate, because I don't want the copper in my body, is a problem.
Right. But your test showed, you have zero copper in your finished beer.
But that's probably because the yeast pulls it out.
That's right.
Yeah. And certainly if we measured the wort before fermentation, I'm going to measure some part per million copper.
Well, and sure. here's a question from Jim. He emailed us, and he said, the configuration of my boil kettle does not... He was switching to one of the Whirlpool chillers, and he wanted to put that in. The problem is, he says, the configuration of my boil kettle does not allow me to sit the immersion chiller into the boil kettle without hooking up the drain tube first. Will it hurt anything to have my chiller in the pot even before the sparge starts and leave it in the entire 90-minute boil? I just need your opinion on any problems relating to leaving the chiller in for the entire length of the boil. Now, this is copper, and he's leaving it in from the very start of when he's sparging to, when at knockout.
I personally think it'll help. I think you want copper. I recommend people take a foot-long piece of half-inch copper pipe, throw it in the boil, and leave it there.
Put your foot-long half-inch pipe into the boil.
That's right, and leave it there.
What if you have a two-inch pipe?
No, it has to be the half inch.
Damn.
I boil in copper all the time. So for me, if there's not copper in the boil, it's not beer. It's just
that's right.
As simple as that.
You've got a considerable amount of copper. Of course, you got a bigger volume of the ratio of one to the other. But even a chiller coil, there's a lot of copper there. There's 25-foot half inch copper there. That's a lot of
surface
there.
It's still
probably okay. Huh?
I think it's fine.
Yeah, I think so too.
Providing it's clean, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, the biggest problem for me with the copper kettles, you know, you can't use chlorinated caustic to clean copper.
Mm-hmm.
And chlorinated caustic is the cleaner in a brewery. That's what you use to clean everything that's stainless. I mean, it's just it's what everyone uses, and we use lots of it, and it works great, and it doesn't take a lot of labor. You can clean in place. You know, just pump it with spray balls, but you can't do that in copper. You have to. You can use caustic, but you can't have any chlorine in it because the chlorine and the copper go through a reaction. So it's a lot harder to clean the copper boil kettle. It's a huge amount of labor, and we go in with a green scrubby every day, climb into the copper vessel and scrub it off. And when we don't do that, let's say, you know, we're too drunk to clean the kettle or whatever it is, what happens is we taste oxidized hops in the next batch because the hop oils coat the wall. And the main reason I can think of to clean an immersion chiller is to get that hop oil off there. So that oxidized hop flavor doesn't come through your next batch.
So you should scrub down your immersion chiller after each batch or before the, at least
or get,
before the
you
next
know batch. I love the idea of a vinegar rinse and then a water rinse. Yeah. That sounds great to me. I mean that
probably cuts
it. I
always just do a water rinse. I take a green scrubby and the hose and just hose it down. You know, scrubbing it. You know, with the scrubby, just getting all the gunk off.
That's essentially what I do.
That's what we do. We climb in with a green scrubby and a hose.
And I don't climb in. I stand next to it. It's a little small for me to climb in.
Ours is 300 gallons, so, you know, it's easier to work from the inside.
I'm working five. Five big gallons. Count them. Five.
Yeah. Right. You want that copper to turn a dull copper color. That's the most passive form.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, actually, when we go to brew our next batch, it's shiny like a new penny. Because that's the only option we've got. I can't wait for it to oxidize over the course of a week.
Well, and the funny thing is, mine's kind of the dull copper all the time, and after I brew and all that. And if I over adjust my mash water or sparge water, it comes out
nice
real shiny.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I know, oops, I think I screwed up on that one.
Yeah, that's pretty low pH, actually.
More beer for Justin.
That's like 3.5 or something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you measure?
I have, but...
you don't know offhand?
No. All right, so Jerry wrote in, and along similar lines, he says, I'm building a custom fermenter, and I'm thinking of using a copper pickup tube. What effect does copper have on fermenting wort, or brass for that matter?
Then you can get in... When you put copper in the fermenter or in the serving side, it's a known fact that copper catalyzes staling reactions. So I don't recommend having a copper pickup tube in the fermenter.
In other words, it can make your beer stale.
Right.
Do you know what staling reaction is?
Let me translate for John here. Make your beer stale. Beer tastes good.
It also... It participates in the trans-2-nonanol, you know, the
ooh, that's a yucky one.
Yeah, the cardboard, the linoleic acid oxidation. It catalyzes that.
You know, a few years back, about maybe 3.5 years ago now, Anheuser-Busch mandated that all pubs that were serving Budweiser replace all of their shanks and faucets with stainless. It was probably going after that flavor.
Yeah,
adding flavor to the beer. Is that what they were worried about?
that is, well, you know, it's a Belgian beer now, so it has flavor. That's probably what they were going after, and it's what made stainless faucets cheap enough for me to buy. You know, but because there were so many Budweiser faucets out there that nobody would produce them until Budweiser decided to make them. You know, decided to require everyone to do it. And my Budweiser distributor is a friend of mine, the local Bud rep. So he'd like slip me shanks and faucets on the side. Oh, you need one of these.
He was slipping you the shank. Just knew I was going to say something.
You know, I'll do anything for good beer.
It's like cue up Jamil and his stupid comments. All right. So one of the things about fermenting wort or fermenting beer, once you add yeast, it's called beer, not wort anymore. Is that it becomes more acidic. So it's far more acidic than what you were boiling, right?
Yeah, and like one pH point, right?
Right, which is considerably. It's like a magnitude 10 more acidic.
More hydrogen, yeah.
And that is going to have some effect on that. Like, you know, the coil I put in the if I over-adjust my sparge water and it comes out real shiny, I imagine it's even worse in the fermenter. And so got to be a problem.
Yeah, and you know, you've got these breweries now that are trying to make these sour beers, and I see these pHs awfully low, 3.2.
Oh, yeah. If you're doing sour beers, it's
3.5 to 3.2, yeah.
So my recommendation
once you get a lot of carbon dioxide in the beer, it's more aggressive chemically to the copper also.
Yeah. Well, I guess where we're headed towards all this is no copper, no brass after the wort's cold.
Right. My recommendation to Jerry was try and go out and pick up a scrap piece of copper at some metal place, and he needs like a couple inches of tubing. You know, I'm sure you can pick that up probably for free most places.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Certainly from my plumber.
Yeah, I gotta say, okay, so Collins Plumber will slip him
a couple inches of tubing
anytime he wants it. I'm sorry, I apologize. Tasty's here, he gives me beer, and then I get out of control. Whole thing goes down the tubes. Clint writes in, he says, Jamel, your quick connects look like brass is correct. Oh, let's see, brass harmful in brewing. I think we covered that, right? So there could be some lead. And, you know, John, one of the things when I started out brewing and using the brass quick disconnects, I worried about lead too. But I saw you had a recommendation on a way to kind of remove some of the surface lead with a combination
solution
of vinegar and hydrogen peroxide. Can you briefly go over that for us?
Sure. Yeah, you make a pickling solution out of two parts vinegar to one part hydrogen peroxide. And this is, you know, normal, you know, grocery store vinegar, 5% acid, and normal 3% hydrogen peroxide that you get from the, from the drugstore. You mix those in a 2-to-1 ratio of vinegar to peroxide, and then put your brass parts in that for, a minute, 2 minutes. You'll see the brass turn from, say, kind of dull to a kind of a buttery yellow color. You'll see it brighten up. And the solution should still be clear when you're done, or fairly clear. If you leave it in there too long, like 5 minutes or 10 minutes or more, the solution will start turning green, and the copper will turn dark. And that means that you're starting to dissolve copper from the brass into the liquid. So at that point, you got to kind of take it out, scrub it up, put it back in with a fresh solution, do it again.
So why is that a problem if you start to dissolve the copper? Hasn't the lead already been removed? You're exposing fresh lead?
You're exposing fresh lead if you let it go too long, because you'll be dissolving the copper away from around it and exposing more. But if you put it in there for just the short period of time, let that copper or the brass part brighten up, about a minute, and take it out and rinse it off, you've removed all the surface lead from that piece of brass.
Well, and I also read on the internet a lot of times people say, well, you know, modern brass parts don't have any lead. There's zero lead in these parts.
That's not true.
And it's not true. I got out a lead test kit, checked a couple of parts. Sure enough, plenty of lead in them.
Yeah, it has to be below 7% in the state of California now.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think they're lower than that. You're saying
3%? 3% for the yellow brass.
Yeah. I mean, California, it has to be below 7% or it can't be marked drinking water safe.
Mm-hmm.
We have some stupid law. I don't know. I don't want lead anywhere near anything. So right. I'm paranoid as crap
really,
about it.
It really is not as toxic as you're led to believe by the media and by the state of California.
Well, it just doesn't go away.
It does, actually.
Oh, really? You can your body processes it?
Yeah, it'll
your body excretes it, out. And I mean, if you're ingesting enough, so you're excreting 92%, so you're retaining 8%. And if you keep taking in enough that 8% is able to build up, then you'll suffer chronic lead poisoning. But
if you eat normally, if you're not starving, Every time you eat, you excrete more lead. It clears.
So it's not something that gets into, say, my brain cells and then stays forever.
No.
Not that you can remember now. That
what were we talking about again?
But again, in children, people with developing brains, not people with brains that are on the downside slope. Probably not going to matter.
Let me offer this too. When it comes to metals poisoning, the symptoms are all pretty very similar. If you've ingested a large amount, you're going to feel nauseous. You're going to get a headache. You're going to get a stomach ache. You may vomit. I mean, those are your first symptoms of metal poisoning. It doesn't matter what metal it is: aluminum, copper, bronze, cadmium,
zinc,
iron, zinc, lead. Yeah, all of them. Those are your signs that you've ingested heavy metals. I remember in college I went to a frat party where they had spiked fruit punch, wine punch in garbage cans, and I had the nastiest hangover that night and the next day, and
zinc poisoning.
Yeah, it was zinc, and I thought, wow, it was just bad wine. But
a lot of plastics have lead in them to make them more pliable and durable, right?
As a colorant, pigments they'll have lead or cadmium. Even cadmium is, where lead is known toxic, but cadmium is very toxic. But again, you have to eat quite a bit of it to really poison yourself.
Okay, we'll try, but I'm not sure I can eat that much.
Yeah,
I had a friend welding on some galvanized metal one time who got zinc poisoning.
Yeah, and, metal fever.
Yeah, and so he goes to the doctor and he says, yeah, I was welding on some zinc and I think I got sick. The doctor said, go home and drink a lot of milk.
Yeah.
That was all the medical attention he got.
And then he died.
No. He's just as abnormal as the rest of us now.
Yeah, but zinc, that's a very common problem, metal fume fever. It's also called welder's flu because it feels like you're starting to come down with the flu.
All right, so one last question before we take another break and get to our live chat questions. Miguel had written in, he had a trouble, he was trying to track down a metallic flavor source in his beer. There's a lot of things that can produce a metallic flavor in beer. It isn't necessarily related to metal contact with the beer. But he did work out, he was using a stainless steel scrubby pad in his kegs to kind of filter out the hop material in a dry hop beer. And what he discovered was these stainless steel scours were made from some sort of low grade stainless.
Yeah.
And they were kind of rusting in his beer, and they would make the beer more metallic and tasting. And finally he discovered that was the cause. Again,
well, fortunately that makes a haze as well, so if you're always looking for clear beers, that you would have detected that just by looking for clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Iron causes a haze.
Something dry hopped, a lot of times that tends to be hazy from the dry hopping. So
not if you find it with like Lucolite or something. I find hazes out. I hate hazes. So
oh, now see, when you get into something like the Pliny, and you're putting in a pound of dry hops.
The Pliny I buy, and I buy Pliny.
A gallon.
Pliny is my second favorite beer in the whole world.
Uh-huh.
And I buy probably two or three pints a week, and it is always crystal clear. So if you're following one of those recipes and it's not clear, then you're not doing it the way Vinny does.
Yeah, hurrah.
Well, you're not fining it and filtering it then.
I don't know what he does.
I don't ask him. No, I tell you, if you put in a pound of hops into 5 gallons of beer, you will see a haze. There's just no way around it.
But it's not a haze I can't find out.
Right, right.
Yeah. And what's your calcium level like, Jamil?
For me, I'm fine with the haze. I believe there's no need for clear beer.
I fine everything.
Again, because I think you're removing some of that flavor and aroma that you're trying to add to the beer.
I think I'm removing the wrong aromas, and I'm keeping the right ones. I'm only saying this after doing it this hundreds of times.
Jamil, when I make a beer that's lacking in flavor or aroma, you know what I do?
I put
more hops or malt to correct that.
Right.
So if you're fining and you're not getting the beer you want, change the recipe.
But hold on. Now you taste the beer before you filter it, and you taste the beer after
I would never use a filter. I would never use a filter. Fining is much more selective than filtration, and I really believe in fining. I would not ever use a filter.
And see, Tasty used a filter.
I may.
He's making hand gestures.
Sure. Fining show. We'll have to bring you back for the fining show.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to talk about finding. I've done so much of it. I do it every day.
I did cuffs here in the studio. Folks.
I did five tanks today, actually. So
excellent.
And one of which is on tap. So I'm finding it while it's on tap. So every pint's getting clearer as we talk.
I think we better go to break. I think it's pandemonium here in the studio.
One of the things we should talk about at some point is passivation internally of stainless.
Internally, like you swallow it?
Well, in brewing, in breweries, we have to passivate, say, inside a heat exchanger, all that. You can't get air in there, so how do you do that?
Well, go ahead, tell us, how do you do that?
I thought we were taking a break.
No.
No cliffhangers?
It was just a weak threat.
So
Justin didn't have his finger on the button, so I couldn't go to break. It's his fault.
The standard in breweries to clean anything is you give it a water rinse, you give it a 140 degree chlorinated caustic cycle. This is anything that's stainless. Then you give it another water rinse. And then you give it what we call a passivation rinse. And we're using an acid. And normally...
Which acid?
Well...
LSD.
It usually comes, in some big bucket marked, something bright. And you don't know what it's in it. But usually it's a lot of phosphoric and a touch of nitric.
Okay.
And it's just standard. That's what you do, and then you do a water rinse, and then you use whatever sanitizer is your favorite. I use 200 degree water as a sanitizer, but most people are using what's the acid?
Starsan.
No, there's
Paracetic.
Paracetic. Yeah, most people are using Paracetic.
Now, all right. So this brings up an interesting question. You got the people with. Counterflow chillers, people with these plate chillers, made of copper, or maybe some people have it made of stainless. And what's the cleaning regimen for that? How should you treat that? And what do you worry about? I mean, should you be pumping all these different chemicals through a copper plate chiller?
Well, you certainly don't want chlorine,
right?
Chlorine and copper is bad. So when I say caustic, I normally mean chlorinated caustic, but I do keep a separate bucket of caustic around that's non-chlorinated just for my copper vessel, which I never use because I go in with a scrubby. But I've got it around in case I want to use it one day.
So people could use something like PBW.
PBW is a good
brewery
one.
Wash.
Yeah, sure.
In their copper counterflow chiller.
No problem.
So
you don't want to leave it soak in it. Mm-hmm. You don't want to leave it soak in PBW or Star Sand because it will eat it in the long term. But in the short term, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then what do? You rinse it? Hot water rinse?
Hot water rinse for a long time. If it doesn't feel slippery, you're probably almost done rinsing.
So keep going if it feels slippery.
If it feels slippery, that's a bad
thing.
Feel it,
and if it's slippery,
if the water or the part feels slippery, then you haven't rinsed enough. Mm-hmm. Slippery means caustic. Uh-huh. It means right. The pH is wrong.
Touch your part, and if it feels slippery?
If it feels slippery, keep rubbing on it.
Or if the fluid coming out feels slippery, then it needs...
Is his finger on that brake button yet?
he thinks I've completely lost it. So after you've rinsed the daylights out of this thing and gotten rid of all the caustic that's in there, then what's your treatment? Do you need to sanitize that? You know, you're
absolutely
talking hot water or maybe Star San or iodophore or any of that stuff.
I like hot water because I trust it. So a minute at 200 degrees, I'm just fine with.
Mm-hmm.
If I've got extra hot water, then I'll use another one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll use another minute.
Mm-hmm.
Hot water is really dangerous, so you don't see Anheuser-Busch using hot water to sanitize because brewers go to the hospital from getting burned by hot water.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't see it used in a lot of breweries, and that's a good thing because it's really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But if you mitigate the dangers of the hot water itself, then it's a very effective sanitizer.
Mm-hmm.
It penetrates better than chemicals do. You know, so if you've got a plate heat exchanger and you happen to leave a little, I'm going to use
pocket the, of crud in there.
Yeah, trub, which I always say true, but that's because I'm from California. If you leave some trub in there, then you will end up being able to at least try to penetrate it. You know, I certainly, any time I've had a bacterial contamination come out of my heat exchanger and I've disassembled the heat exchanger, it's because there's been trub in there and it's gone through my sanitation of 200 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't guarantee that you're going to sanitize with heat. Sanitizing with heat doesn't replace cleaning.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got it clean, you hit it, get it hot, it's sanitized.
Mm-hmm. Lisa? Pasteurized to a good extent, which is all the sanitization you need.
Right. We're not talking sterilized. We're talking sanitized.
Right. Okay. Right. Well, let's go to break. For God's sakes, let's go to break. Drink some beer, and we'll come back. We'll get into all the listener questions. There's a big load of them, and we'll also have our final runnings back after this.
Smart. Brew strong. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, Push, the new brewery's looking good.
Thanks, Finn. Piece by piece.
Well, let's fire her up. Whoa! Is that a new kettle?
Yeah, just got it brand new, but paid half price.
What? And that blade scale?
40% off.
The new tap handle?
$5 instead of 13. Got a new regulator for the brew stand, too, but $5 instead of 25.
Dude, where are you stealing all this stuff from?
Where else? The More Beer deal of the day.
Announcing the Beer, and More Beer deal of the day. Every day, a new fantastic deal from big items to small that will blow you away. Boil kettles, carboy carriers, sterile siphon starters, digital timers. Watch morebeer.com every day for a new deal, and you just might find the item you've been waiting for at a price you cannot believe. Hurry, because stock is limited on most items.
And that sweet Guinness cap, let me guess.
The More Beer deal of the day.
Yeah, I knew it. Come on, let's brew something.
Find the More Beer deal of the day at morebeer.com. Celebrity voices impersonated.
Attention homebrew shop owners. At Firman Tap, they know you're tired of buying the same old gear that everyone else has. That's why Firman Tap offers the newest and most cutting-edge brewing equipment known to man. Since 1998, Firman Tap has been leading the fight against the boring and mundane by offering strange, unique, and just plain smart equipment. Like their stainless stone false bottoms. Never deal with the floating plastic hassle of other false bottoms again. And since they're made from stainless steel, they'll last a lifetime. Firman Tap's line of copper wort chillers are the best on the market, designed to cool your wort faster and more efficiently than other immersion chillers. They actually invented the equipment to make these chillers not only work great, but look great too. How about a fantastic line of ingredients, including vanilla beans, sorghum extract,
blue agave extract, hot bitterness extract, unique wine yeast, green coffee beans, sake kits, all stuff you can't find anywhere else. FermentTap carries all the standard products and equipment you need as well, such as all grain systems, stainless hardware, kettles, carbonation zones, you name it, they've got it. FermentTap's entire line of products has been helping retail shops meet the demands of their customers for nearly 10 years, and they want to help you too. For more information, see them on the web at FermentTap.com or call Jason at 1-800-942-2750. FermentTap, better beer through innovation.
You're listening to the Brewing Network.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew Strong.
Hey, we're back, and as you can tell, we're running long on this show. That's the problem. You get your experts into the studio, and I just can't cut these guys off when they're dripping gems here. You know, when the pearls are forming necklaces out of their mouths. You can't
keep working. Keep working.
Yeah, that's a stretch, Jamil. Come on,
you can't cut that off. Oh, Tasty, it's all your fault.
It's all my fault.
Yeah, it is.
Is there a fluff girl around here somewhere?
Okay, so I apologize to all our faithful listeners. I apologize. It's all my fault. I'm a terrible person. I shouldn't be.
Have another beer.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, who cares? All right. If you're listening live, okay, so you go to the brewingnetwork.com. And first off, what you're going to notice is a completely redone website. I love it. It is absolutely beautiful. It's easier to navigate. It's a gorgeous site with a lot of great things happening to it. I don't know if everybody here in the studio has seen it, but absolutely fantastic. It's worth taking a look at. I thought the previous site was actually quite good. I think this one is as good a site as you're going to see on any website there. It's fantastic. Lots of great stuff there.
I'm running like Netscape 1.2. Does it load up for me? Yes.
No, you're not. Come on.
It probably will. Because the guy who did it knows what he's doing. I think he can make it work on a lot of different browsers. You're not going to run into troubles there. And if you go there, you click on the Chat Now button. And that's going to take you into the chat and people listening live. We do these shows live. There's no editing. There's no, remastering of this thing.
You're sure we can't edit some of those comments?
No. I say them and they go right out.
Yeah, even if it's Jamil, we don't edit.
That's right. And it's absolutely done live. We do two shows. We're going to do this metal show. And if you're listening live, you're going to get the a show on enzymes coming up next. And if you're listening in the archives, it takes about 2 weeks between each show. We space them out about 2 weeks. So you want to be a live listener, and you get a chance to ask your questions. And Justin has gotten quite a few questions here. It's quite active on this topic. I knew this would be popular.
I would go so far as to say that it's our most popular of all your shows.
There you go.
So far, in terms of questions.
See, John, I told you.
Lots of questions.
Good response.
So it's going to take us a few just to get through it. I want to start by, Colin, correcting you just for a second. If you're going to use Trub because you're Californian, then it has to be Hella Trub.
Well, you know, actually, I say wort, okay. And I say trub.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to stick with trub because you're Californian, then you have to put hella in there.
Wouldn't it be trub, dude?
Yeah.
A trub, dude. I got a hella trub in the bottom of my kettle, dude.
Okay, so I do really have a lot of questions. I'll try to get through them quickly. One of the first that came through, when we were talking about copper early on, is how much copper is too much copper? And I know we went into this in depth, but maybe we could use this as, Colin, you said put a copper shank in your boil kettle. How much is too much of that?
I don't know if there is such a thing. I think the yeast has such a strong affinity for the copper. I don't think there is too much.
Palmer, what do you think?
Well, there's also the solubility of copper in the liquid, right? It's going to reach a certain point. You're not going to get any more.
Well, I don't think you can get to saturation even with anything we can imagine.
Okay.
Fill the whole kettle with a copper scrubby, maybe. I don't know.
Palmer?
Yeah, I don't know, but you know, according to the Industrial Metals Handbook, where it talks about industrial safety and toxicology.
What page?
don't have that.
It's on the nightstand.
If you look in the appendix in How to Brew, it talks about the lowest lethal dose, which is 200 milligrams per kilogram of body weight.
Oh shit! So, that's a lot.
Yeah, so yeah, you'd have to ingest a couple of copper pennies worth. Although these days are all zinc anyway. Okay. But, if you're not throwing up and if you're not turning green, then you're fine.
All right. Clarification about the passivation cycle you guys were talking about earlier. Someone had kind of interpreted as, so is this a bath of dangerous acids that we can't get anyway?
Pretty much.
It is. Okay.
Well, the nitric's hard to get. It's not impossible to get. The nitric's hard to get, but you can get phosphoric anywhere.
All right.
Yeah.
But yeah, nitrix, it's a little dangerous to deal with, and so it's hard to get for a good reason.
And again, I think John's point was, if you clean it really well, use the scrubby, use whatever, cleansers you need, and then expose it to the air, dry it off, expose it to the air, it's going to passivate right there. You
well, and, that, and that's the issue we've got is, in the heat exchanger, we never know if it's dry.
Mm-hmm.
You assume that it's going
to
drain.
It doesn't have to be dry. It just needs exposure to oxygen. It can be wet with oxygenated water. That will work.
And water will pick up oxygen like you wouldn't believe. So,
well, that actually might be a good idea is to just put it in a recirculation loop with your oxygen stone on.
Yeah.
That would take care of it. Yeah.
It's and by a cleanser, ordinary kitchen cleanser, Revereware, Clean King, Barkeeper's Friend, all of these cleansers that are recommended for cleaning stainless steel cookware, that's exactly what you want to use. It takes the heat tin off, it cleans up the stainless nice and bright, and you're all set to go. The nitric
PBW works great, too.
Yeah, it really does. So going back to what you were working with earlier, Colin, you do the caustic rinse, or you do the caustic, you do a rinse, and then it's very common to do an acid treatment after that to neutralize the caustic, and then another rinse. And that acid is usually phosphoric and sometimes with a little bit of nitric. And it helps keep the stainless passive. But other people use paracetic acid sanitization. That again is also a part and parcel a neutralization step for the caustic. So I think a lot of professional brewers feel that they have to passivate their system after every use, and that's not necessarily the case. I think it's already passive. What you're mainly doing is neutralizing caustic
in case there's some residual.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And certainly, we certainly always do pH measurements at every point in the process. And if you ever end up with some abnormally high or abnormally low pH, you start looking for a cleaning error.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, some more questions I got. And in terms of cleaning, someone wanted to know if I scrub that burn spot off of my kettle and leave it nice and shiny, how long do I need to wait to brew in that pot?
You really don't. If it's nice and shiny, then it's clean, and then it's passive.
Then it's fine. Okay.
And that's actually new. 10 years ago, we were at Beer, Beer, More Beer. When I started there, we were telling everybody 30 minutes.
You were? Okay.
So that's new news to me. So, there's probably a lot of information out there that started out of Regan, Dylan, and I.
Okay.
because we thought it was 30 minutes.
Gotcha. Okay, here's another question. The blue that you were talking about that shows up on your stainless steel. Somebody asks, will that go away eventually if I just leave it alone? Or will it get worse? Or will it stay the same? Or do we really need to get in and scrub that off?
It should get worse.
Okay.
It should corrode at some point.
Yeah. If it doesn't, hey, you're lucky.
Okay. So we need to get in there and take it off.
It would be best if you got in there and took it off. And it comes off real easy with the cleanser and a scrubby.
Okay. Here's a real nerdy question for you, Palmer. What grade is the best for welded fittings? And they gave a couple examples if you want those.
Or 316L.
The 316L, okay.
Yeah.
How about fermenting in aluminum? Is that something? Is that harmful? Something we can do?
That's fine.
It's fine.
No problem there. It is a more acidic solution than the wort itself. But again, it goes back to, do you have a seasoned aluminum vessel, one that's, you know, the oxides, the protective oxides have built up, that makes it, you know, much more inert to the beer. If you got a bright and shiny brand new, you know, aluminum kettle there that you're trying to ferment in, you're probably going to notice a metallic off flavor.
Okay.
But you know, if you're using a seasoned pot, one that's nice and dull, shouldn't be any problem at all.
Aluminum scares the hell out of me, and I stay away from
it. Well, and again, on the aluminum, when you're talking seasoned, I think you can also just go about cleaning it really well, like you would your stainless, same sort of process. And then again, expose it to oxygen, let it sit for a while, and it should.
But it takes longer for aluminum.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. You can accelerate that by sticking it in the oven at 350 for 10 minutes, half hour. And that will help the dry oxides build up. It's the hydroxide, aluminum hydroxides, that are most susceptible to chemical dissolution.
All right,
and this is, I think, one of the reasons why I'm afraid of aluminum. And aluminum as a metallic form in our metals industry is only about 150 years old. And we didn't really have it as the modern method of making aluminum from aluminum oxide ore didn't exist 150 years ago. And a couple of high school students actually created the method that we all use now. And it just hasn't been in our environment long enough for us to really understand what it does. Now, does that mean it's a problem? No, maybe not. But it's something that I certainly have a warning flag about.
You feel we should be 250 to 300 years at least? 500? 750? 1,000?
1,000 generations.
Wow.
When something's been involved in our lives for 1,000 generations...
Well, we haven't had stainless.
Then we've adapted to it.
We haven't had stainless for 1,000 generations, though.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind that you're ingesting 150 milligrams of aluminum in every antacid tablet that you take.
Not me. I use calcium carbonate.
Okay. Or when you spread deodorant on your
barkeeper's friend.
I don't use underarm deodorant either.
800 generations.
We were going to mention that.
And all for the same reason. I'm just that paranoid about aluminum. And that could be, you know, that might be just some reactionary thing on my part. But
it could be,
boy, when you start looking at the fall of the Roman Empire and you see all the lead plumbing, it took them hundreds of years to realize that lead was shortening their lifespans. Hmm. Average lifespan was 28 years.
Well, and they didn't even realize it because... I mean, you talk about the Franklin expedition, the Shackleton, all those different expeditions where they had canned food, which was the new miracle thing, and they had lead solder, and they all get lead poisoning and tended to off the.
Well, the original canning was done by Napoleon's army, so that he could march across Europe. And it was his chef that invented it, and he canned in champagne bottles, so he knew better.
Hmm. I just want to point out that everyone in the studio knew that Colin doesn't wear underarm deodorant.
That's why they put me on mic 3 way over from everybody else.
Yeah,
you stay in this little booth over here. It's really just because the acoustics are much better in here.
Yeah. Okay, will a brass ball valve screwed into a stainless steel or aluminum kettle corrode because of the dissimilar metals, or is the contact time just too short? It's a question.
Basically, at the home brewing level, the contact time is too short.
Okay.
At Colin's level, he's got 5 days, 6 days a week contact, and he's going to experience corrosion.
All right.
Yeah, and that's what we found. About 1,000 batches in, we started seeing our brass fittings corrode.
Well, can't you throw maybe some Teff tape on there and kind of reduce the problem a little
bit? Isn't that just the insulator in the battery?
It does help, but you still have proximity. You still have the electrolyte, and it'll still corrode. The galvanic series is such that carbon and gold are at the top. Then it comes chromium, stainless steel. Then copper is right below that, and then further down you have aluminum and zinc, magnesium, and so anything at the top of the chart is not going to corrode. It's the stuff at the bottom of the chart, relatively, that's going to corrode. So if you connected brass to aluminum, then you'll see the aluminum start to corrode. If you connect aluminum to stainless, you'll see the aluminum corrode. If it's brass to stainless, you'll see the brass corrode.
Okay.
Well, and here's one thing. You know, if you're looking at these quick disconnects, not too long ago I was working with the folks at More Beer. They had come up with stainless disconnects, just like the brass ones, but made of a good quality stainless steel. They operate the same way and designed to, you know, to thread in same sort of fittings, replacements for those brass ones. And if you're worried about lead or you're worrying about corrosion or something like that, you know, these are a fantastic product. I started out with them, and they gave me a set and said, hey, you know, we just here's some prototypes of these. Give it a shot. See what you think. And I went and brewed with them. The initial ones had a little bit of a leakage thing there, and I told them, hey, you know, this, that, the other thing. They went and they made some other prototypes to try those. It worked fantastic. I really, really thought that those were great. I haven't replaced all my brass ones with them yet, but I think previously the stainless quick disconnects you could get were, like, you know, for hydraulics, and they were, you know, $80 a set.
Absurd, yeah.
Yeah, the More Beer guys, they've, you know, sourced these, you know, designed them, had them manufactured, and you get them, I think, what, $30 a set, something like that?
Something like that.
You know, about a third of the price that you're paying before. And, you know, it's more expensive than the brass ones, but I know you could get these and not worry about them at all as far as, you know, lead or dissimilar metals or all that stuff.
Even cleanliness in general. They seem to be easy to keep clean.
Uh-huh.
I built my brewery out of tri-clover clamps, because when I'm using a tri-clover, I feel like a real brewer.
I just grab myself in different spots, and that helps me.
But show a lot of butt crack.
You can find those on morebeer.com, www.morebeer.com, and great product. I don't know if everyone's known that they came out with those.
No, but, you know, I didn't, and I used to help Chris out a lot on that kind of stuff.
It's pretty recent.
I didn't know they were there. Yeah. I'd love to go check them out, actually.
Very cool stuff.
Have to stop by.
Check out our brew system out back, actually.
Oh, does it have it on them?
We switched out our fittings with those as well, and we started with the plastic and didn't like the plastic, and we had a few copper because that's what we had, and then we just went to the stainless because I'm just kind of like you, Colin. I'm a bit of a freak about, you know, worrying about dying.
Well, you know, there's the other end of that. The alchemists used to ingest mercury on purpose because it made them more vigorous and more crazy, I think, is the word we'd use nowadays.
I see. We don't need that around here.
Yeah.
Somebody else asked, should I break down and clean all of my weldless fittings on the kettle every time I brew? Is that necessary because of this corrosion?
No.
Again, usually those have a, you know, some sort of a gasket in between.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if it's similar metals, then you don't have the problem. But and if it's getting hot enough, I would be more concerned with
the
sanitary aspects
and
of
the
it
hop
and
oils.
The oxidized hop oils and things like that versus galvanic corrosion.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I might clean them so they're clean to brew with, and then I don't think you have to worry about corrosion at all.
Okay. Here's a good question, I thought. You were talking about immersion chillers and different things and the metals turning black. This person said, my immersion chiller is pretty much all black, and it pretty much stays black even after I've used it. It doesn't get that shiny bit that we all get out of ours. So he kind of said,
tell him to add some gypsum.
Well, he wasn't really asking. He just said, I hope that's okay. I don't think he wanted to find out it's not okay.
No. pH is way too high.
Yeah, but his pH is really high.
Yeah, his pH is too high. So if he's did he say an all grain or extract brew?
He didn't say. He just was mentioning that his stays that color.
Yeah, he may have a water that's
really alkaline.
Really alkaline. Yeah. And that's a problem. You know, he might try sourcing some different water. If he's an all-grain brewer, and he should be adjusting the pH of his mash and his sparge water as well to something in the 5.2, 5.4 range, and then he'll see it shine up a little bit. But his beer will improve if he does that as well.
Okay.
I learned a nice little tidbit about that, just to get on a sidetrack here, between the 5.2 and 5.4 range. that's a big range for me. Mm-hmm. I can hit those numbers a lot tighter than that. And 5.2 I really like on light beers that mm-hmm. I want to be mm-hmm. crisp and refreshing. For hoppy beers, 5.2 is doesn't work for me. And for real hoppy beers that I want that nice, bold bitterness out of, I do 5.4. Because I get it's a little harsher bitterness, but mm-hmm. but it's a more present bitterness.
Well, that's odd, because on the maltier beers, I like more of a 5.4. And on the lighter beers, I like more like a 5.2.
I don't make any malty beers. I either make dry beers that have no hops or dry beers that have lots of hops. So.
All right, just a couple more from the chat room. Same with the immersion chiller. You guys are talking about how to keep them clean or to clean them. Someone asked, should we store it in water all the time? Would that help to keep it clean if we just... when we're done using it, stored it
no.
in water. No?
Okay. No, it's going to be detrimental, in fact. I find things actually corrode in water worse.
Because okay. remember, there's oxygen in the water as well.
Yeah, I used to store fittings at Beer Brewer. No, you guys weren't around. Jameel was, but you guys weren't around when I had my test lab at Beer Brewer More Beer. And it was really common for projects to get started and then abandoned about halfway through because something was more pressing. And so you'd have some piece of copper laying in some cleaning chemical for months, maybe years. Yeah. And you'd pull it out and then
the bottom half was missing.
And you'd call up the manufacturer and say, hey, I left this copper fitting in your PBW and sure enough, it corroded. Well, how long did you leave it there? Oh, it's only been 18 months.
Yeah. All right, so don't do that. Okay, and I think the last... I do have a couple more. Does beer stone form on copper? This person thought the only part of their kettle that needs cleaning is the copper cleaning, the copper bits. So does beer stone form on copper?
I don't get beer stone anywhere, on the hot side of my process at all. All the beer stone I've ever gotten has been on the cold side. Beer stone is calcium oxalate. The oxalates come from the malt. The calcium comes from your water. If you get your water chemistry straight, you shouldn't really have an issue with it at all. But I do see it a lot on homebrew stainless fermenters.
You get it from residual caustic in your system too.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah,
they call it scale when it's from the caustic. Like if I put hot PBW into a keg. And I try rinsing out with cold water, I get scale built up in that keg like you wouldn't believe.
Well, that's not calcium oxalate. That's something different. Right. Calcium oxalate actually precipitates out of the beer.
But this is something you get when you're doing caustic. You use hot caustic and then cold rinse, it'll deposit onto the side of the keg. So don't do that. You want to rinse with it. If you're using hot PBW in your keg, clean your kegs. You want to use hot water as your rinse until you get rid of the slippery factor, and then you can use a colder water because otherwise it's going to deposit right on there and you build up this rough stone on there or scale, is what they call it,
and it'll harbor an organism and cause you all sorts of problems. So
that's why I clean my kegs on a hot day because the hose water gets hot in the sun.
Yeah,
and I do my initial rinse with hot water.
There you go.
He's got a hot hose.
All right, last two questions from the chat.
Scaly hot hose.
Are about leaching. Again, with leaving in water, this person asks, it's Dressel Brew in the chat room there, if I fill my hot liquor tank a day or two in advance, will that leach anything bad in my hot water? He's using a Sankey keg for a hot liquor tank.
No, not at all.
Be fine. Okay.
Perfectly.
Just
fine.
A couple of days, no big deal.
Months is he's going to be fine.
Okay.
Unless something grows.
I see.
You know, as long as he heats it up and kills whatever.
Yeah, I've heard that the layer between the air and the water and the stainless is you can get a corrosion happening there, and it will pit the stainless on that air water interface.
That can happen. Yeah.
Okay.
So you don't want to leave it for very long because it will. It can.
But if it's pure water, it shouldn't happen. But if you have like a cleaner PBW or some other chemical in there, then it's more likely.
My hot liquor tank's only empty for as long as it takes me to boil beer.
Yeah.
It's literally full. You know, I boil for 90 minutes, so it's only empty 90 minutes 5 days a week.
Yeah. Well, it's probably hot a lot. I think if it's hot a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you leave it room temperature, you're going to pick up more oxygen. Maybe that it has something to do with that. Hey, this is just stuff I read.
The chemistry of actually air and water is really fascinating. And you actually can build up a temporary hardness just by leaving hot water or water in general exposed to air for a long period of time. You can actually watch it change.
Well, that's a good question, I thought, for homebrewers, because a lot of people do like to set up their hot liquor tank, their water, a couple days in advance of the brew day. All right, last question. Here's a good one for you, Palmer, to finish off the chat room. Somebody asks, hey, doesn't the oxide layer that forms on lead actually seal off any lead leaching?
No.
Okay. Good enough.
Yeah.
No.
You got your answer, now go away.
Yeah, it's not a very protective oxide.
So educate me a little bit on all this. So we talk about oxides that are protective, like the chromium oxide or the aluminum oxide. Is that a PK? Is that what it is?
So the
PK of lead oxides then are higher than, say, the PK of chromium oxide. Is that what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, their stability PK in a solution or potential in the oxygen potential in the air. They're less protective. They're the less stable.
So they'll actually, say, go into solution at pH of 6 or something, whereas, say, a copper oxide won't go into solution till pH something really low, like 1 or something.
Yeah, that's right.
I was trying to clarify that in my head.
And different chemicals, every metal or every oxide will have a different PK depending on what solution it's in.
Sure, that makes sense. Because it's going to react with something, right?
Right, and that's why copper and brass and beer get along, whereas copper and brass and tomato sauce don't. It's the chemical that they're actually in and their activity in that chemical.
So it's not simply a pH issue.
Right. It's not simply a pH issue. It's also a chemistry issue.
All right. That's all I had from the chat today. Great work in there, everybody. Good questions, I thought, and a lot of good participation. That's what the show's about. So thank you for doing that for Jamil.
And stick around. We're going to be talking about enzymes in our next show. Let me kind of recap some of the things I think we came up with in this show. Give you a final recap here. So stainless, you want the 304, 316, and there was also the 202. But any of those are fine in general. Those are good for welding. It's the 316L and
or 304L.
Or 304L. Most of those stainless products you're going to find would be good. Anything I think in the 400 series, you said the 416 might be the issue.
Right.
But other than that, you're going to be okay. Most of the products out there would be just fine, right?
That's right.
I thought you had something else to say there. Okay.
I could talk about...
We're in the recap here. Come on.
Okay, yeah.
You should have said it early in the show.
Don't get me started.
Right. Aluminum is okay.
We're going to start calling you nickel. Put a nickel in the slot.
Yeah, put a nickel in the slot. I'll give you a slot.
In my opinion, aluminum is a perfectly fine brewing element.
Better conductivity of heat and distribution of heat, but it's not going to be as durable as stainless will as far as chemicals, cleaning, acidity, stuff like that.
Which is why we use copper, because it transmits heat even better than aluminum.
So copper's even better than stainless or for a brew kettle, things like that, but it's very
copper's
expensive.
Copper's about twice as good as aluminum, and aluminum is about five times as good as stainless.
So if I could still do math, that's 10 times better copper than stainless.
Yeah.
There you go. That's why they attach those big old plates to the bottom of some stainless kettles to help distribute heat throughout the kettle, right?
Right.
So aluminum's all right. You don't have to worry about Alzheimer's unless you're Colin or Justin. But
it's too late.
They're going to suffer anyways.
It's our families that'll suffer.
There is some durability. Yeah, well, they need to suffer.
We'll just get younger every day.
That's right, yeah.
Aren't you my third grade teacher?
Okay. So copper.
Let's have sex again.
I'm not the only one drinking here in the studio, as you can tell. Copper, the consensus here is you really don't worry. You're not going to get too much copper in your wort, and pretty much all of that is going to get eliminated by the yeast in the tube in the fermenter. So you want to make sure and clean it. If it looks green or blue or black, you probably want to take the scrubby to it and some water and get that thing polished up.
Some vinegar.
And generally it'll take on kind of a dull copper look to it, and that's perfect, and you're fine there. If you're getting a black look to your copper right after you boil, and then you do it again and again, and it just looks black all the time, you probably need to adjust the pH of your mash or your water or whatever you're brewing with, because you're not getting quite acidic enough. You should clean it first, and then see what you can do there. Lead, not so much of an issue. Lead is a terrible thing, and you don't want lead in you. Probably the best thing, rather than using brass fittings, is to go to morebeer.com and check out their stainless quick disconnects instead. You know, try and use stainless parts where you can, or copper parts would be a good choice. No lead. And there's the pickling treatment that can reduce the issue. If you're somebody like me that really doesn't care about their health, and, you know, I figure I'm just on the downside of my mental acuity anyways. I just use brass fittings, and I haven't noticed a difference.
Look how I turned out.
Look how I exactly. So I think, if you have a concern, definitely, you know, get yourself some stainless fitting, you know, replace the brass. But if you don't, if you got the brass and you're not too worried about it, again, don't give the beer to the kids because they're growing.
Let's actually recap one of the really interesting things. So we're talking about toxicity of, I believe it was lead at, 200 milligrams per kilogram of body weight?
Copper. That's right.
Yeah. Was that copper or was that lead?
That was copper. Okay. Lead is 1,300
1,300 milligrams?
Yeah.
That's a huge amount.
It is.
Yeah, that's not,
if you
know,
notice that you're getting heavier.
If you notice that there's big parts of your fittings missing, then you're probably consuming too much lead. I mean, there's a huge amount. This isn't like the pit you didn't notice that poisoned
it's
you
like,
here.
It's like swallowing, you know, one bullet for every kilogram of body weight. I mean, a bullet would
even pass through. You'd have to like crush it up into powder and then solubilize it in some acid and then consume it.
That's right. Yeah. I mean,
so there, you're still okay to swallow bullets.
So
they'll pass right through. You'll see
so you
like
made me perfectly comfortable with lead, but I'm still afraid of aluminum.
Yeah.
All right.
Lord help you if somebody shoots you with an aluminum bullet that has to stay in you, huh?
Yeah, you can see why I love doing this show. It's always a great time and very informative, I think.
You don't have to get too serious.
I think we learned a lot. I learned stuff from this show.
I did, for sure.
You know, you bring in these good experts, and it's amazing the stuff that you can learn. And I think we answered a lot of questions for people. I think we did an excellent job, everybody. I think this is something where, you know, people are learning about the things that affect their beer and things they want to know. And that's the purpose of this show.
Hey, John, thanks for the education. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for listening. I was afraid I was going to bore everybody to death.
All right, if you're listening, go to thebrewingnetwork.com and check out all the great stuff there. There's a store with excellent shirts. I wear them all the time. Books, signed books, memberships to the AHA, Brew Your Own. I write a column for that, and so does John. And so you can get even more of our stuff. And, sign up for BYO, and a good portion of that subscription actually goes to the Brewing Network. It's a great deal. Anyways, good show, everybody. Brew Strong.
Brew Strong.